Well, let me first say thanks for inviting me. I've been looking very much forward to actually coming to Oxford. We already had some discussions via email because we share many research questions and so on. So what I'm about to present is not so much a paper, but rather a report on work in progress. It has some traces of a positional paper, or however you want to call that. So don't expect final results. Numbers will change in the course of my PhD projects and so on. But what I want to present today is very much on conceptual issues, which I think we share. So let me start with a short overview of what I'm about to present. So we're going to start with a short overview about the corpus of Erasmus correspondence. Then we're going to switch to the process of data capturing and modeling, followed by some remarks on the common approaches to analysis and visualization, so statistical, spatial, and network representations. And then the last, and probably for most present, the most interesting part of how I imagine all projects in the digital Republic of Letters should move to, with an outlook on what I'm currently working on. So, I'm not going to introduce Erasmus, because, let's be honest, everyone knows who Erasmus was. A short overview over his network of correspondence. So in numbers, 3,150 letters about have survived, circa 2,000 written by and 1,150 written to Erasmus. Those are the usual numbers. I can calculate them much closer, but it's still in flux, so I'm not going to present actual numbers I've calculated for the most part. You have 202 individual locations, so locations which are identifiable, from which Erasmus and his correspondents wrote letters, and 730 correspondents were involved. And if I say correspondents, I mean individuals, because mostly we have a correspondence from one person to another person, but you also have correspondence from an individual to a group of people, or correspondence from one person to an institution. That, of course, has some implications if you're thinking about network representations and so on, but I'll try to cover that later onwards. The relevance of Erasmus correspondence as a historical source is very obvious. If you read any book on the Northern Renaissance or the Reformation, you will stumble upon how important this corpus is. It's the major source for the intellectual life in the first half of the 16th century. And it's not an exaggeration to say so. How does one capture correspondence networks? Most of you probably know or have a rough idea on how one does something like that. But I'll go through the process nevertheless. So, you usually start out with a printed edition, which usually comes with nice lists of letters. This picture here shows one of those lists from the most current edition of Erasmus Letters, the subsection of the Toronto edition. The full title is Collected Works of Erasmus, subsection The Correspondence of Erasmus. So, as you can see here, you have a letter number just to the left, followed by the sender or recipient, followed by the source location, so from where the letter has been sent, and you have an annotation regarding the date of dispatch. And as a first point, you can try to extract this kind of information and put it into a spreadsheet. Because if you think about computing anything, you need structured information. And I've called this capture because this term implies that it's not just transcribing information to data, but making conscious choices of how you make this transformation. And, well, this is the most simple form to capture information. So you choose a letter identifier for your own internal use, and I've chosen this format that I use the three first letters of the specific corpus, followed by an abbreviation of the edition I used, and then the internal letter number used in that edition. So it's the creation of a unique resource identifier. And then in the next column, I have the letter number, in which volume this letter has been edited, and then a split between sender and recipient, basically just pulled out from the label you find in the printed edition. And I just extracted this label from the printed edition, so it's kind of copy and paste. If you have a printed edition, you can OCR it and then extract this information. And then I have one column for the date of dispatch. And as you can see here, we have one of the earliest letters of Erasmus. You have a lot of uncertainty and ambiguity towards the date of dispatch. For one letter, the year is not certain. For others, for example, 149, the specific day is not certain, and so on. And I have the source city as annotation. So in the form as it is being presented in the printed edition. So there are some pitfalls while capturing letters in general. And the first pitfall is that which I mentioned before, uncertainty or ambiguity relative to the date of dispatch, the source or target location, the sender or recipient, and you have this phenomenon that letters can have multiple senders and or recipients. And with regard to the specific corpus of Erasmus correspondence, I have the problem to merge two major editions. As you might know, the standard edition of Erasmus correspondence is a product of Oxford. It has been prepared by Percy Allen in the first half of the 20th century. And it's, even nowadays, still the standard edition when it comes to the Latin text in itself. But the most current edition is the aforementioned Toronto edition, which is a translation project, but which also predates certain letters, and so on. The problem, though, is that as today, CWE covers maybe half of the letters, and they won't finish any time soon. So I can say with absolute certainty is that I'll finish my PhD project before that edition is going to be complete. That, of course, is kind of a problem because I have 15 volumes of the Toronto edition, and for all the letters which come after that, I have to use the edition of Allen. But it's not simply using the next volume of Allen, because you have to think about which letters have been redated and so on. So it's all about making a concordance between the two editions, and that's what I've done so far in my spreadsheets, so that I can see which letter number does a specific letter have in the individual edition. Well, there are some obvious possible solutions for uncertainty and ambiguity relative to the date of dispatch and the other problems. So, if the date of dispatch is uncertain, you can just use a time frame. Historians know the procedure. You use the terminus post and antequem. So you determine in which time frame a letter could have been written. And you can then introduce a couple of columns for start date and the end date. And you can even split that into year, month, and day, so that you can represent in your spreadsheets uncertainty. With those columns, of course, you can't do proper computations because you might have empty entries for a day or a month. So you have to choose a very specific date which is computable in the date time format. But you can do that most of the time. So let's say you have a letter of which you know this letter has been written in the middle of August 1503. Then you could say, I'll choose as a start date the 1st of August 1503 and as an end date the 15th of August, for example. So it gives you one way to compute. For the source target locations, it's pretty obvious that you use something like geonames, so that you come up with a numeric unique identifier. But sometimes you encounter letters where you know, okay, this letter has been written in England, but you have not much more information about it. So what you can do for those cases is that you create a location entry called unknown and then the country code, which then, of course, enables you to compute how many letters have been written from a specific country in modern terms, and to account for those letters. And for the sender recipient, as well as for the locations, if there is uncertainty involved, usually marked by a question mark in the printed edition, you can just use Boolean operators with a simple choice between yes or no. So you have two columns, one for sender, one for recipient. Sender certain, yes, no. Recipient certain, yes, no. Which enables you, if you use database technology, to query those columns. And one workaround, and network analysts won't be happy with that one, but then again, I'm a historian, not a IT person. One workaround for letters with multiple senders and recipients is that you can split them up. So let's say you have a letter from Erasmus to the brothers Nordhoff, one of his first pupils. What you can do is that you assign each letter a unique ID, but in the next column for the internal, not the internal ID, for the ID the letter has in the printed edition, you have the same number. Using this approach, you can filter out those splits later onwards, but the advantage is that you have, in terms of networks, for each correspondent, one node. If we weren't to do that, we would have, in a network representation, not two nodes, one called Christian Nordhoff and one Henry Nordhoff, but one node called Christian and Henry Nordhoff, which is not exactly what we want in a network representation. At the same time, it's important to preserve the information that this was not a letter of the type 1 to 1, but rather of the type 1 to many, in this case, 2 recipients. One workaround for that would be that you classify letters with a very simple schema, so that you have something like 1 to 1, 1 to many to 1, many to many. So that if you were to query your database, do some network visualizations, you wouldn't be able to highlight those edges. Then, of course, you can create a list of correspondents. And what I've done here is that I've chosen the most common name variation for this person in the virtual international authority file, which is a project which tries to bring together all national unique person identifiers. So you have one numeric identifier for each person. Of course, there are some individuals involved which do not appear in this database of numeric identifiers, but for most of them, you have a numeric identifier. Then, of course, you have to classify the correspondence. Is it an individual? Is it a group? Or is it an institution or a body? And very obvious, you try to classify it by gender, and not much of a surprise, there are only a few female correspondents in the whole corpus. And then the standard name form in one very important handbook, which is the handbook Contemporaries of Erasmus. It's a blessing to have this handbook. It has been edited by the same people who publish the Toronto edition. And you have biographical entries for all of Erasmus correspondents. So, other pitfalls stuff like name variations, aliases, and so on. And sometimes, even the same edition uses name variations for one individual. So, as you can see here in volume 5, it's spelled Jan Robbins is spelled like that, and 5 volumes later, you suddenly have this spelling of the name. And then you have the problem of something I call here, in lack of a better term, status enhancements. So you have a letter from one of Erasmus correspondents to Giovanni de' Medici, who later onwards became Pope Leo X. And you have one letter of Erasmus to the young Prince Henry, who later onwards, of course, became King Henry. You need to resolve those variations to really uniquely identify each correspondent. Otherwise, again, if we think about networks, you do not really want one node being called Prince Henry and another one being called King Henry, because it's the same person. And the same procedure you did for the correspondence, you can do for the locations. So you create a unique resource identifier for each location with international country codes and so on. You make up a concordance of the different spellings in the different editions. So the Elm edition, for example, never used, or mostly never used, the native spelling of the name, but rather the English spelling, and the Toronto edition uses the native spelling. And then you can identify where this location is situated in terms of countries, their provinces, and so on. And of course, you can add geo-coordinates, which is sometimes not an easy process to find, for example, a monastery which has been destroyed and which has not been that well known. So you have to do some research for some locations. And the next step then would be to go back to your initial spreadsheet and replace all the entries for places and centers and recipients with those unique identifiers. And that's basically the end result of your work with spreadsheets, because then you can make up a very basic relational database. I for once used MySQL, a very basic schema which links together the letters, the locations, and the correspondence, which then allows you to do some querying. So, for example, you can run, by using the structured querying language, you can run a string which filters out all the alien letters in the corpus. When I say alien letters, in lack of a better term, I mean those letters which have been included in the printed editions, which have Erasmus neither as a sender nor as a recipient. Those letters, I think it's about 42, have been included because they shed some light on Erasmus' lives. They have been judged to be very important, but they kind of distort the field. And if you were to do some calculations, you have to filter them out. And you can do that very easily by using SQL. And then what I did for internal usage, I used a very nice framework to produce a web front end for that SQL database, where I can select the senders, recipients, source locations, and so on. So very basic queries. It's much more comfortable to query the database this way than to run scripted comments. Right, and you can do, of course, basic visualizations. In this case, I've used the Google Fusion Tables API to show the different locations, in this case, from where Erasmus has received letters. Okay, once you have this data available, there are some common approaches that you can actually do with them. And you probably know many of them. You find them in current journal articles on correspondence networks. So statistical representations, how many letters have been written in total for each year, and so on. Of course, you can calculate the same for locations and so on, and you can do some geospatial representations, which nowadays is fairly common since the rise of spatial humanities and that we have such simple tools to make such representations fast. And lately, very much in fashion, network representations. And I have some examples here to show you how the traditional approach to these issues looks. So this is a breakdown of the number of letters per year over the span of Erasmus' life. What you can see at first glance is that usually Erasmus, usually for all of his life, Erasmus has written more letters than he has received, with a few exemptions. And what you can see also are gaps in the historical tradition. So for 1491, there is a gap. And then again, during his trip through Italy in 1509, 1510, roughly. That's okay, but when you start to think about what that chart tells you, you come to the conclusion it tells you only a certain amount. You can do calculations for the top recipients. So who were the top recipients, and then compare that to the number of letters these recipients have written to Erasmus. And you usually can see the same phenomenon. Erasmus sends more letters than he receives from each person, but there are a couple of exceptions. You could, of course, do the same the other way around. And spatial representations. I've used, in this case, Quantum GIS, so the open source variation of ArcGIS, which allows you to do much more than Google Maps. And what I mapped here are the locations from where Erasmus has sent letters over the whole span of his life. And I've used something called a convex hull to mark roughly the area in which those locations are situated. And you can then do the same for the locations from where Erasmus has received letters, so from where his correspondents have written letters. And the same, of course, you can use this convex hull to mark the rough area. You can then overlay that. Please note that I haven't marked the locations where we have Erasmus correspondence and where we have Erasmus, so locations from where Erasmus and his correspondence write letters. They should be in another color, but nevertheless, it should give you an idea. So what you can see is that his network spans most of Western Europe, but he himself rides from smaller corridor, basically from Oxford down to Italy and so on. So spatial representations, that's helpful to get an idea how such a network looks, but it's the same issue that you have when you look at those statistical representations. You look back from the point of his death, so it's retrospective. And in terms of analysis, this might not be the most useful thing to do. The same is true for network representations. So you take all of his letters and pull the information out of the database, and the state-of-the-art software to do that nowadays is Gephi, which has database connectors. So you can use your same query strings to import the data into Gephi, which is software for social network analysis. And you get then this radial layout, and you can see, okay, the correspondence in this layout, algorithms who have exchanged the most letters with Erasmus are closer to the center and vice versa. The nature of this network as an egocentric network is due to the fact that you capture the data based on the printed editions of one individual. So, with those few mentioned exceptions, alien letters, you have the letters Erasmus has exchanged with this correspondence and the other way around, but not the letters they have exchanged with one another. Which might be, of course, the much more interesting stuff, but keep in mind we have 730 correspondents. It's just not doable to capture all those connections they have with one another. And of course, the historic tradition is very scattered. And also usage of SNA metrics, so you can calculate a lot of fancy numbers in social network analysis. It's not that constructive to do so at this point due to the ego-centered capturing approach. So the problem with all those approaches I've mentioned before is that they disregard the dynamic evolution of correspondence networks in time and space. I think that's a very obvious point to historians, but for data scientists, it appears not to be that obvious. So, I've phrased here a couple of questions concerning time. So, how did the network evolve within a certain time frame with regard to the number of correspondents involved, the frequency of epistolary exchange, the quantity of letters exchanged, and total per individual exchange in this time frame, and so on. And in terms of the time frame, this time frame doesn't have to be 1 year marked by the 1st of January at the end of December, but rather you have to choose appropriate time frames. So you could choose, for example, the time frame from Erasmus' birth till his first trip to England, excluding the letters he has sent during his trip to England, so his formation phase, his first formation phase. And that would mean that you would make a cut in October 1499, if I'm not mistaken, and you would only calculate numbers for this time frame and analyze the number of correspondents and so on. Because obviously it's interesting to see what happens once he travels for the first time to England, visits London and Oxford, makes new connections, and what happens afterwards, after he returns to the continent. So informed choices, that would be my first point. And you have some questions concerning space, that's only small subsections of questions involved, of course. So which geographical space does the correspondence network encompass within certain time frames? So think back to those convex hulls. We don't want to have the retrospective, but we want to capture a specific time frame, as I mentioned before. Or how did a change of residency by Erasmus impact the composition of his correspondence network within a certain time frame? So, one example is the one I mentioned before, his correspondence network until his first trip to England. You have 99 letters in total, 85 by Erasmus and 14 to Erasmus, and within the corpus you have 5 AD letters. And as you can see, in terms of the locations, Erasmus wrote only from 7 different locations and received letters from 3 different locations. So even if you don't see a map yet, you get the picture that when we speak about his correspondence network in that time frame, it's not yet this vast network spanning all of Western Europe. So you can then do, of course, a small breakdown of letters per year, in this case for 1499, excluding a certain amount of letters, and so on. You could even break it down further, do calculations per month, and so on. And you can do some statistical representations for the locations from where he has written letters or from where he has received letters. And as you can see here, he receives letters from Paris, from Stein and Lobson. So Paris, where he studied, and Stein, his monastery, and Lobson was one particular correspondent. And this is a geographical representation of his network in this particular time frame. And as you can see clearly, it's just a small part spanning the region from nowadays the Netherlands down to the Ile-de-France, from where he himself wrote letters, and the scope of letters from where letters had been written to him is not much wider, which is already some progress when we talk about correspondence networks. And you can do network representations, so you have a much smaller number of correspondents, and you are interested then in how does the network look. You get again a radial layout, and in this case it looks a little bit more interesting because for this example I left in the alien letters. So here we have the connections the correspondents have with one another. And for the next slide, I actually have to switch to Lizzie's laptop because we can't install Gephi on the conference desktop. Alright, so what you see here is how his network looks in Gephi. And what I've done here is that I scripted this network in XML in a file format called GexF, which is supported by Gephi, which is able to carry information about the dynamic evolution of the network. Because the correspondence between two people happens in a specific time frame or at a specific point of time, and if we really want to get an idea of how such a network evolved, how interactions took place, we have to use this kind of dynamic representation. And I'm going to hit play here, and there you might get an idea of how such a network evolves. I wish I could zoom in, but you already can see here that the connections appear and disappear, and you get more connections, and the strength of the edges represents the number of letters. So that's my second point. I think we should use this kind of dynamic network representations. Static representations can be helpful. I could, of course, do a very specific query to filter out exactly that point, and do a snapshot. And then I could do that for all other points of time before and compare them. But just to see how such a network evolved in a specific time frame, this is very helpful. The problem, though, is for the time being, you have to script it manually. And so we need some scripts to export the data from the database into the specific file format. Because if we talk about over 3,000 letters, it would drive you not insane, but it's not a nice thing to do. Right, I'm going to switch back to HTMLA. All right, so what we should do to further explore correspondence networks is conceivable in two ways. You can say, okay, I have one correspondence network and another, and I can compare them, I can look how they intersect, and that's very interesting, and I'm going to talk about it later. But in terms of querying the network or the database to ask specific questions about the composition of the network, you need to include more information. Very basic information is usually included in all databases of correspondence. So you have something like date of birth, date of death for each correspondence and so on, but that's only the starting point. So I'd say we have to go in two directions. We have to capture additional relational data about the correspondence. That is to say, we do not look on the epistolary exchange between two individuals, but we take into account other forms of relations those individuals might have had with one another or other persons. So there's a long list, I've only chosen a few here. Kinship, of course, teacher-pupil relationships, which occur very often in the Erasmus corpus. Professional-mercantile relationships, patronage, personal encounters, in my opinion, a very important point, because this marks a very distinct quality in the relationship between two persons. So that's the first point. The second point is that we also need to capture more additional attribute data. So that's essentially prosopographic data. And since we have this aforementioned handbook, Contemporaries of Erasmus, we have a wonderful source to capture this kind of information. So attribute data, that would be something like education, academic degrees, ecclesiastical status, social origin or standing, something which I called here socio-professional role, to reflect that something like being a pope is not exactly a profession in our modern sense. And so on. But you have to come up with a schema which is applicable to most correspondents. So you have very detailed lists on benefits some correspondents held and so on. But then you have to start to think about, is that really essential information? What kind of questions can I answer if I have this information? And do I have this information for enough correspondents to be meaningful? In this particular regard, I'd say I wouldn't include benefices, though it might be helpful for very specialized questions. Right, and some example questions you could answer if you add this additional relational data. So you could ask questions like where did the personal encounter take place? And you can think about it in a very structured way. So a personal encounter takes place at least one, but maybe at many locations, involves at least two, but sometimes more, individuals, and is situated at a specific point in time or within a time frame. And you could apply the same schema also to attribute data. So if you think about the education one individual receives, this education usually takes place at one location or sequentially at many locations within an institution located at that specific location and is again situated at a specific point in time or rather in a time frame. So we could, for example, ask ourselves, where did Erasmus correspondents receive their educations and how does their origin and their location of education, how do they correlate? So, where did the Dutch scholars attend universities? And did that shift over over time? And so on. And another point I'd like to make is why we need this dynamic data. If we only have static data, so one entry for something like socio-professional role, and that entry would be Pope, then you have a problem when you hit an earlier time frame in the correspondence, where this one particular correspondent, who later became Pope, wasn't yet a Pope, but a cardinal, for example. Why is that a problem? Yes, if you calculate the number of correspondents who fit a specific socio-professional role, then suddenly you might have two or three popes in your statistical representations and so on. And this example here, you have this one letter from Anton van Bergen to Giovanni de' Medici at a specific point in time when Giovanni was not yet Leo the X. So, a couple of questions you could answer through the inclusion of dynamic data. When did two correspondents reside in the same location? Which might give you pointers to what kind of interactions might have taken place. So, of course, this is sometimes counterfactual thinking, but it might give you very important hints on what might have happened. What places did individuals correspondent did the individual correspondents visit during travels? Which is a point also other projects make. So we have the Stanford project about mapping the Grand Tour, which puts much emphasis on travel. And of course, many of our scholars involved in Erasmus correspondence network lived very itinerary lives, so they moved around a lot, and it's important to track this movement. How were correspondents related to another? Which correspondents had a teacher-pupil relationship to another, and so on? When did a specific socio-professional group first engage in epistolary exchange with Erasmus, or vice versa? And was there a specific time frame in which a socio-professional group was dominant? So, for example, you could ask, when did church prelates appear for the first time in the network of Erasmus? And when did they disappear? When did they disappear? Or did they disappear at all? And so on. But then again, you have to think about this attribute as being dynamic. So, and another point I'm not quite sure I'm gonna do in my own project, but of which I think might be very helpful, is that you try to incorporate the content of the individual letters. Those of you who heard the talk last week probably heard about technology like topic modeling and so on, which has been employed by the CKCC project, but there might be another approach to incorporate this kind of information. But first, what's the point of incorporating that? And that's that we could try to understand not only who talked to whom in form of a distant reading, but also about what they talked. So example questions would be, with whom did Erasmus discuss his work? In situ, as you can see, this Christiani. Which other persons or works got mentioned during this discussion? In which time frame did this discussion take place? And of course, if you think about the bigger picture, if you were to integrate more correspondence networks within the same time frame, you could track how Erasmus correspondents discussed his works with other correspondents. And one possible approach to do this indexing would be to simply reverse engineer indices. So we have in the supplemental volume of the Allen edition indices for mentioned works, mentioned persons, and so on. Usually they don't make your life easy because they don't give you the letter number, but only the volume number and the page number. So for each entry, you have to go back and then figure out the letter number. So that's work you have to do. But doing it this way, of course, you will encounter many dubious points where Helen was wrong and so on. But it's a start to capture this kind of information without really digging into computer linguistics and trying to use proper topic modeling on this corpus. Right. So, one short outlook on what I'm currently working on, and that's intersecting networks. So, I was interested in how his correspondence network intersected with other correspondence networks. And in this case, I've chosen a smaller network of a humanist called Jakob Winfeling, who lived most of his life in Heidelberg and in Strasbourg and Silvester. And as you can see by the numbers, it's a much smaller network. But you have a number of intersections. And that means that Erasmus and Winfeling had 32 mutual correspondents. And that, of course, leads to the question, who were those correspondents? Why did exactly these correspondents overlap? And then again, space and time, why did they overlap and when? So here I've chosen a static representation where we again look back and we can see how these networks intersect. In Gephi you actually could zoom and filter and so on. But if we think further, if we would include dynamic network data, we actually could see how these two intersecting networks evolved and so on, given that we have the technology to export dynamic network data automatically. And you can do the same again in retrospective to compare how these networks intersected geographically. So the bluish area is from where Winfeling has written, the reddish area is the area from where he has received letters, And the other two areas you already know, those are the ones from where Erasmus has written and received letters, which is a very quick way to get an idea of how those networks overlapped. Right, I think that's all I wanted to present today. Thank you very much.